Last week we looked at a very short, well, this is the third week. So the first week we did quite a beautiful introduction. Then last week we looked at the 10 words, the Decalogue, what we commonly call the 10 commandments. And I'll now give you the words that finish that 10 commandments. Then there's another quite beautiful meditation from chapter 6 right through to chapter 11, and I'll be selecting from it today. That's our work today. Next week, you'll have the delight, if you do, please read before you come here. It's a much better way to do the study. From chapter 12 right through to 25, are the statutes and whatever ordinances, you know, that are the central part of this re-look at the Torah. These are all the commandments not written by God on Mount Sinai, but given to Moses and handed on to the people just before they go into the Promised Land. That's the way it's dramatized for us. Now, that's next week, and you'll read hundreds of little bits of law, and some of it you'll enjoy, some you won't, and I'll do that with you next week. So our job today is to look at chapter 6 through to 11. And we begin with the words that conclude the Decalogue. These words, I've got the Hebrew there purposely, Dubarim, these words, Yahweh spoke with a loud voice to your whole assembly on the mountain. Brackets, chapter 12, which we'll do next week, through to 25, Yahweh didn't speak on the mountain. He gave them privately to Moses, who then gives them to the people later. Their later law, less significant, not central. Okay, so these words, Yahweh spoke with a loud voice to your whole assembly at the mountain, out of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, all stage props for God's presence, you know, power. And he added no more. He wrote them. This is a bit special. Yahweh wrote them. You'll find that statement in Exodus chapter 32, equivalently 15, also saying how Yahweh wrote the Ten Commandments. So he goes on, he wrote them on two stone tablets and gave them to me. Yes, you'll find that mentioned in the writing in Exodus 32:15 and in Exodus 34:1. But if you read Exodus 24:4 or 34:28, Moses wrote them. But that's exactly what the Vatican Council says about the scriptures. They have God as their author, but they also have the human author. So they're trying to say two separate things. They're not actually talking about who picked up the stylus. God wrote, they came straight from God to us on the mountain. Moses wrote them. In fact, neither God nor Moses wrote them. They came from that inspiration of God, of course, and the Yahwism, which is the religion of Moses, handed down through the people who actually wrote them. We haven't the faintest idea. But we're talking about authorship. Is that all right? Where they're coming from. Yahweh said to me, go say to them, return to your tents. But you, Moses, stand here by me and I will tell you all the, this is next week's work, all the mitzvot, commandments, and hukim, statutes, and mishpatim, edicts, the different names for the that you shall teach them so that they may do them in the land that I'm giving them to possess. Pretty clear, isn't it? You've got a distinction between words, dubarim, they're the 10 words, and these other different levels of legal system in the country that weren't written by God. They were told to Moses, so the story is, and they were handed on now for the first time to Moses, by Moses, on Mount Nebo as he entered into the Promised Land. So only the Decalogue was revealed to the people at Horeb, at the desert mountain. Moses alone heard the commandments, statutes, and edicts that he's now telling the people in Moab. Okay. Deuteronomy chapter 5, 32-6:3 reads, "You must," this is Moses to the people, "you must therefore be careful to do as Yahweh your God has commanded you. You shall not turn to the right or to the left. You must follow exactly the path that Yahweh your God has commanded you, so that you may live, and that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land that you are to possess." What we've got there is an absolutely typical theme of the Deuteronomic school. You find it in Deuteronomy, you find it all the way through Joshua, Judges, the books of Samuel, and the books of Kings. This idea, we've got to be careful with it. Sometimes it's called success theology. I think that might be a bit unfair. Meaning, if you do good, you'll prosper. If you don't do good, you won't prosper. You see that? A bit simplistic, and it doesn't actually work like that. And when you look at Jesus and see him being murdered in his middle 30s, it becomes clearly apparent that prospering and innocence don't go together. And what's it mean to prosper? You know, does it mean a long life and plenty of kids and all the things that we would think would be nice to have, and possessions and so on? Or so it's subtle. They're not too subtle about it. But what they are saying there, you'd agree with too, everyone agrees with it, so I guess we'd have to, is that God's blessing is what they're talking about. And God's blessing can't come unless we welcome it. We have to obey, meaning listen. That's what obedience means. I guess you know that by now. A deep audience, listening from real close up. So that sense that obedience is at the heart of our life is Jesus' teaching as well, clearly. And that's what they're saying there too. If you want to prosper, though they might see prosperity a little bit unsubtly, I don't know, obedience, listening, openness, like a flower welcoming the sun and the rain rather than closing off, is essential. And that's, I think, what he said there quite beautifully. Don't turn to the right or left. Follow exactly the path that Yahweh has for you. And that can be tricky too, I think, can't it? Because you could think that God has a kind of a will for you that's fixed and you better find it or you're lost. I think it's better to see God as constantly adapting to you and to me. That God's will is that, well, Jesus said it, God's will is that you live and live to the full. So it's the liberating will of God. That's what God's will is. So, but God isn't saying, though I might have thought it as a young man, what does God want me to do? He wants me to be a priest, so I better be a priest. And if I don't become a priest, I fail. I don't think I thought like that, but you could. And then for the rest of your life, think you're not in the right path, you know? Okay, let's say whatever I do, fail or not fail, whatever the prodigal son did, that's not the end of the world, because God is constantly loving and wanting the prodigal son to live and live to the full. So, and God meets us where we are, whatever decisions we might have made, good or not good, wise or unwise, and we come and God meets me there and you there and invites us to the next step of love. So listening, doing God's will is a matter now of taking the next step of love, really, as best we're able. And God will love me wherever I am, even like the thief on the cross at the last minute. Does that make sense to you? I presume it does. But we've all got to be careful of thinking that God's got a fixed will planned for all eternity for us. God doesn't have plans, I'd say, because God is, and you can't plan unless there's a future. But there is a constant love drawing us, and it's never too late to fall into line with that loving will of God. Now, this is a continuation of Moses' words. This is the commandment, the statutes and the edicts, there's our three words again, that Yahweh your God has charged me to teach you to observe in the land that you are about to cross into and occupy, so that your children and your children's children may fear Yahweh your God all the days of your life and keep all his decrees and his commandments that I'm commanding you, so that your days may be long. Pause, brackets. Imagine yourself in exile having that read to you. You're about to go back home. You've made a mess of things. Jerusalem has been destroyed. We followed the king when the king himself wasn't following God, etc., etc., etc. They're working all this through. And I'm not suggesting this was written during the exile, but it could have been. And in its final form, it was kind of put in place there or thereafter. So it's good to put yourself in the audience that's actually hearing these words proclaimed in another situation, because it fits perfectly. Hear, therefore, Shama, hear. We'll come to that word a few times. O Israel, and observe them diligently. We don't know what they are yet. We've got to learn about them next week. So that it may go well with you, and so that you may multiply greatly in the land flowing with milk and honey, as Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, has promised you. So the authors are writing about their forebears lost in the mists of history, who first entered the promised land in the 13th century BC, writing about them in a way that's making sense to the audience in exile about to go back home. And I think you can see all that connecting. And it still applies to me and you now, of course. And then comes a text that you know so well, Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 5. Hear, here's the word Shama, etc., the Shema. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Love means be in a covenant relationship with God and do God's will. So love is something you do. It's not something you feel. You might have feelings. That's up to you. Whatever you had for breakfast might affect your feelings. But this is about a commitment to a covenant. Love means obey the commandments. That's why Jesus can say, I have one commandment to give you, love one another. Sounds a bit funny in English straight away, doesn't it? I have one commandment, love. Well, how do you command love? You can command love, because love is obeying the command. Love is doing God's will, whether you feel like it or not. That's what love is in the terms they're using here. So to love your God with all your heart, mind, all your inner, coming from inside, you know, not just out there doing it. All your soul. Soul's a funny word in Hebrew, but not a funny word, it's a beautiful word, but it's not really a Hebrew word, soul. The best word I know for soul is the Black African soul music. It means your longing, your whatever's in you that's longing, desiring, crying, laughing, but whatever that is that you talk about when you talk about soul music. So with all your longing, maybe you could say, and with all your might means all your strength to do the will of God, whatever it costs. So I'll go back now to an earlier text. And that text, as you know, is quoted by Jesus. Matthew, Mark and Luke all have Jesus quoting that to the rich young man, remember? Is that where it is or not? Oh, I just can't remember. I don't think it is with the rich young man. So Deuteronomy chapter 4 reads, we've done this already last 2 weeks ago, but I'll read it again. Israel, give heed to, another way of translating this, Shema, give heed to the statutes and judgments that I'm teaching you to observe. Assemble the people for me and I will let them hear. Here's the word again, Shema. So it means hear, heed. My word, so that they may learn to fear me as long as they live on the earth and may teach their children so. It's almost the same as what we had in the last page. In your distress, when all of these things have happened to you in time to come, you will return to Yahweh, your God, and heed him. I've just put that in there to see how different ways of translating that Hebrew word Shema, to heed him. Fear the Lord means, it's going to vary with the way you look at God. Basically it means, or you know, the seventh gift of the Holy Spirit, awe and wonder in God's presence. So it's a respect, awe, wonder. Now, how much what we'd call fear is involved is going to depend on your image of God. And their image of God allowed for a lot more fear than hopefully ours does in view of Jesus. But so they probably had a lot of fear of this God who killed people when they were young and punishes, and you know, the whole Old Testament view of the control of the world. But in the light of Jesus, fear becomes much more, I think, awe and wonder, but also an element of fearing our capacity to let all that go and lose it. So it's a big subject. Moses convened all Israel, we saw this in chapter 5, and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances I'm addressing to you today. You shall learn them and observe them diligently." I've done that just to show you the theme coming all the way through this literature. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 to 12, we'll look at now, just more for meditation than anything. "Keep these words that I'm commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children. Talk about them when you're at home, when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise." Brackets. A young woman came to see me a while ago. She's doing teaching in the Catholic school system, in the university, Catholic University, and she wanted some kind of a reference from the parish priest to get a job. She's not quite at the getting of the job, so I don't have to give you all the details, but basically that's what she's looking for. But she doesn't come to Mass regularly. So I said, well, I can't give you... what they're looking for is the knowledge that you... She said, but I've learnt all that. I know what to teach, you know. She knows what to say. She's learnt it and she would be good and comes from a good family, all of that. But that's not what the Catholic school system's looking for. What's the good of me getting up and say, if you get up and say to the children that that communion's important and you don't go, what are you teaching? And what message are they getting? Clearly. We're trying to do this with the parents too. In fact, I've got a lecture to give to them tonight on the parents of for their kids for First Communion. But I won't go into that. But that'll be the main one of the points I'll be making. If you tell them that First Communion is really important, and I said it's First Communion, it's not last, it's first, so, and you don't do it, what message are the kids getting? For crying out loud, can't you tell what message they're getting there? It's not important because Mum and Dad don't bother. So somewhere or other, we've got to be careful for the little children and not give them the wrong idea. So teaching isn't just telling people what you know to be true. You have to be living it or it doesn't get across. So anyhow, that's what he's saying here. And actually the Jews are good at this. Maybe better than our generation is, I don't know. In our family we had regular prayer at home and it stopped and the next generation didn't really pick it up. The rosary didn't get, you know. I'm not suggesting the rosary, yes or no. But if you ask yourselves, what kind of prayer do you have in your home? If you don't have any, then we're not. Talk about it when you're at home, when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them, these laws of God. They're so precious to you. Bind them as a sign on your hand, meaning what you do. Hand is action. So what you do is the key. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead. What you think. You know how we, at the beginning of the gospel, we make a sign of the cross on our forehead, on our lips and on our heart. So that the word of God will be in our mind, on our lips and in our heart. Well, it's this equivalent thing here. So fix them and write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Well, the Jews do, some of them do that. They've got what we call the phylactery, which is a Greek word. You know, the little, they have a little thing here and it's bound around here and they have it on their arm. You've probably seen it. With, and inside it are significant texts, including the one we saw before. Listen, Yahweh, the Lord your God. It's a love the Lord your God with all your heart. That's one of the texts in there. So they've got these texts, and that's like a scapula. We wear a scapula. Well, they wear that on their forehead to remind them to keep it before their eyes and in their mind. Here, make sure in your actions you follow it, and on the doorpost, make sure you live it. And as you go into the street, that's what you take in. Well, they're good little symbols. We need them too. We need some symbols. I hope in your home you've got a crucifix. But they went out of fashion a bit, but God knows why. Or an icon, or a picture of Our Lady. If you haven't, get one today. And put one on your kids. Give them to your kids for their wedding present. Something lovely. It has to be beautiful. It needn't be as ugly as the ones that I grew up with. But still, little kids can look at it. I remember we had, I might have told you, just between our dining room and a little tiny corridor, and then there was a lounge room around there, just above the dining room, was that purpley, I think it is, not purple, but blue, black. It was Jesus weeping over the city. And you've all seen it, I'm sure. But I can remember as a little child looking at it a lot. So something's going into your soul. And if there's nothing around... in our little presbytery, I'm recommending it to you. I am recommending it to you. Only because I did it, but I mean, when I go, it might go. But I found a bit of... I wish I could get the one I want, but a bit of... They call it Bartik, do they? Mm-hmm. And it was an Indian. When I came back from India, I brought it with me. And it's Jesus looking like in a lotus position, but it's Jesus. So we had that there, and then someone bought me one because one I'd love is the one with the Trinity on it, you know, the Rublev's Trinity, but I can't find it. And if you know there's one, pay for it, buy it, I don't care what it costs. I'll go and sell newspapers to pay you back. But it's over the television, you see. In other words, the television is in the room. We've got a television at home. I was looking at it last night at a video for a while. But when we turn the television off, you've got blue tack and it hangs down. So you've got a little picture, holy picture there. Because why should the television dominate a house? And why should it be the centre of attention everywhere? It's either a big black box or the bloody thing, excuse me, it's raging away in the background. So I'm just recommending that. I mean, that's what I keep telling people to do. Or put it in a cupboard and pull it out when you want it. Then you're not tempted to just flick it on in case... Well, I'm talking to you all like your little children, aren't I? But what's wrong with having holy pictures in your home and icons and crucifixes that just remind you and remind anyone coming into the home that there's more to life than hamburgers and Days of Our Lives or Desperate Housewives? So that's what he's doing there. And we could learn that from the Jewish community. Home prayer, home liturgies. That's kept them going for 2,000 years. The synagogue is there and the temple doesn't exist anymore, but in the home they have the Sabbath and little practices that they learnt as children and treasure, and good on them. Okay, so that's the advice he's giving them so that they can hand it on to their children. When continue now with Deuteronomy. When Yahweh your God has brought you into the land that he swore to your ancestors, Abram, Isaac and Jacob, to give you, a land with fine, large cities that you didn't build, houses filled with all sorts of goods that you didn't fill, hewn cisterns that you didn't hew, vineyards and olive groves that you didn't plant. And when you've eaten your fill, take care that you do not forget Yahweh, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slaves. It's pretty beautiful, isn't it? Chapter 6, verse 13, Yahweh your God you shall fear, him you shall serve, and by his name alone you shall swear. Remember the temptations of Jesus in the desert? And the devil tempts him 3 times. And to each of the devil's temptation, Jesus quotes from the book of Deuteronomy. That's the 3rd one, when he says, if you fall down before me, I'll give you everything you can see in front of you. I'll give you the whole land. And Jesus says, Yahweh your God alone will you serve, etc. Quoting, in the Greek it's a bit different, but quoting that actual text. Do not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples that are all around you, because Yahweh your God who is present with you is a jealous God. Jealous is a tricky word in English. It's the same, by the way, in Greek as zealous. Jealous. So when it becomes a vice, jealousy is the other face of envy. Envy is when you haven't got something but you want it. Jealous is when you've got something and you won't share it. You're jealous of what you've got. We often use the word wrongly, but that is the difference. And you're envious of what you don't have, you're jealous of what you do. She's my wife, she won't be dancing with anybody else. Or this is my, you know, that kind of... But in its positive sense, it means that you treasure what you have. It's something you respect and treasure and love and surround with care and all of that. So God is a jealous God, meaning he loves these people and he wants them for himself and doesn't want them prostituting themselves with false gods. The anger of Yahweh your God would be kindled against you and he would destroy you from the face of the earth. There's the older way of looking at God. That the woman caught in adultery would have been thinking that when she was thrown down in front of Jesus and would have been absolutely surprised when he said, I don't condemn you, but don't sin again. When he loved her out of it. So would the thief on the cross have been surprised. Do not put Yahweh your God to the test as you tested him in at Massah. Another text quoted in the Mark and Matthew and Luke in the scenes of the temptation of Jesus. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test. So we've had 2 quotes already in quick succession from that spiritual attempt to get to the heart of Yahwism, which is the book of Deuteronomy. That's what it is. It's trying to get to the very essence of the faith of Israel. And so obviously Jesus thought it was beautiful too. Chapter 6 goes on, you must diligently keep the commandments of Yahweh your God and his decrees and his statutes. Those 3 words we keep coming up to, that he commanded you. Do what is right and good in the sight of Yahweh, so that it may go well with you, and so that you may go in and occupy the good land that Yahweh swore to your ancestors to give you, thrusting out all your enemies before you, as Yahweh has promised. We'll have to come back to that. So part of this mentality is that God got Moses through Joshua to wipe out all the people of the land, so to give them the land. We'll have to have a deeper look at that. Deuteronomy 6, 20 to 25 talks about teaching their children. We've done a little bit on that and I won't go into that with you. And chapter 7 begins when Yahweh your God brings you into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and he clears away many nations before you. These are the nations that were said to be in that part of the land. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites. Seven nations, mightier and more numerous than you. Seven looks a bit symbolic, doesn't it? And when Yahweh your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, you must utterly destroy them. Now we're right on this topic that's very typical of the Deuteronomists. The herem or haram, the verb. Herem is the destruction of anything that's not pure in their religion. So we're into the jihad kind of stuff, aren't we here? The equivalent. That's what. And so what's this coming from? Did that happen? Did God actually command the Israelites to go in and destroy everybody? I mean, the God we know couldn't do that. The God they knew could, and that's really problematic. And it's still problematic in Israel, I would think, this kind of view of God. So, and it's not monotheism, so it's a bit, it's quite wonky intellectually, but anyhow, I'll give you my little comments on it. This text, writing some 600 years later, this is, I suggest to you, the Deuteronomist's way of underlining the absolute necessity of not allowing any compromise in the people's religious values. They must not compromise their values anywhere. Their survival as a people is at stake, the authors are telling them. However, historical investigation doesn't support the idea that the local inhabitants were wiped out and replaced by invading Israelites. Another book that I gave him, I called Unearthing the Bible, is it?
The Bible Unearthed,
that I've talked about with you before and some of you have read, I think, by a Jewish archaeologist, Finkelstein, and a Jewish historian, Silbermann. So doesn't make them good, but at least they're Jews writing, so it's not anti-Jewish. And they and many others, with the collapse of Russia, basically, of the USSR rather, there was a lot of migration of people from that part of the world into Israel, and that's been quite problematic, I have to say. But anyhow, that's what they. So there were too many people. Supported monetarily from America, basically. But so they got them doing. There's been an enormous, like, filtering through the land, inch by inch, almost archaeologically. And there's a whole lot in that book that's fact now, and it's discovered, and they've worked out. The fact is that the people who became followers of Yahweh in Canaan were locals. It was a conversion process, not a dominating process by a massive lot of Israelis that came in and destroyed the people and emptied them out and took their land. That's not what happened. There's no sign. I mean, archaeologically, that didn't happen. Now, what's more likely is that a small group came in with a new understanding of God, Yahweh, which is quite remarkable. And the subject, most of the people in Canaan were subject. See, they were run from Egypt, and they had these little pockets, like Jerusalem was one of them, and there were other little pockets where they, and we've known this for a long time, read the names in the Bible. The princes and kings of whatever you're going to call them, the bullies or the mujahideen or whatever they're blooming well going to call them, of these various places, none of them have Semitic names. So it's the breakdown. In that 13th century, there was a breakdown generally of this whole area. This is the period of Troy and the collapse of the Mycenaean Empire. This is the time of the Odyssey and the sea peoples, people in sea coming and marauding all around. And they nearly took Egypt, except for Ramses II, who had his slaves building a lot of... He kept them out of Egypt. But the Philistines is one group of them. They came in about the year 1200. They're a group of these sea peoples, possibly from the Aegean, the islands of the Aegean, or Mycenae, or whatever. They were kind of European, and they came in knowing how to use iron, and so the chariots, they were stronger, and the spears were stronger. So on the flat land, they did. So, you know, I'm going too far now, aren't I? But so you've got all this happening, and generally the people had to escape from these people up into the high country, and they are really, they're the poor, they're the farmers, they're the ordinary people. And the idea of a God who actually cares for the poor and the broken and the widows and the ordinary people, can't you see why they might take hold of that? Because it's the only one that'll suit them, because they are the poor. So they took over this idea of Yahweh and were converted the way people in South America were converted, or the way Ireland's all converted, or the way you're converted, or I'm converted, about an inch from the top and underneath. I just wonder. No, conversion's a tricky thing, isn't it? And you look at Christians and you just wonder about, I wonder about myself, wonder about you, must wonder about yourself too. So we're talking about we can be culturally Christian and kind of, but deep down we can still do what a lot of the Germans did under Hitler. And I'm not mocking the Germans, they were probably much more Christian than people around them. So it's tricky stuff, being really, really follower of Jesus. How deep is it? So this is really a way of, well, historical investigation doesn't support the wiping out of the people. It didn't happen. So what's happening 600 years later is when they are now basically all converted, they're talking about these groups way back and how we got the land, and they're saying, look, God destroyed them for us. It's a bit of a wonky idea, but they've got it, and it does have harmful effects. But they're basically writing, it's not relevant at their time. They don't have to wipe out anybody. So it's more a way of saying, look what happened in our ancestors, and they got that wrong, but you stick to your faith, hold on to it, don't compromise it, etc. Was that a bit fast, or was I clear enough? It is a bit fast, but that's my best way of putting it, in a hurry. And the text goes on, Deuteronomy 7, for you are a people holy. This is beautiful. This is the beautiful side of it. You're a people holy to Yahweh your God. Yahweh your God has chosen you out of all the peoples of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. Now that's beautiful, treasured possession. Segula. I should have a dot in the Lamed, but I forgot how to do it. It's a double L in Hebrew. Segula, treasured possession. That word, segula, appears only... Would it be better if I turned it off? Is it blowing cold air on you? Okay, all right. Segula, it appears about... I'll give you some of the texts. It's a very... I've got an image for it that I don't say it's the translation of it, but this is what comes to me when I read treasured possession, is being in mass, vested, looking like something from outer space. I've never seen anyone dress the way I dress in mass. Oh, well, maybe I have, but that was at King's Cross, I think. anyhow, leaving that aside, because I say to some of the kids, you ever seen a man dressed like this? No. All right, we live with it for a while anyhow. Treasured possession. You're there and you see a family coming in, and you see little Hannah, 2 years old, with a rag doll, and she's got her hair scruffed by the scruff of the neck. And it's been everywhere. The dog's mauled it. It's been trodden on. It's kind of found its way. It's put in the laundry by mistake and come out. And it's just a complete mess. But there's no way she's going to let it go. And she must take it to bed with her and take it everywhere with her, because it's her segula. It's her little treasured possession. Well, God's a bit like that with these people. He's saying, you are my segula. You're the ones I... Here's some other texts. It is you, Yahweh, who has chosen us out of all the peoples on the earth to be his people, his segula. We'll find that later in Deuteronomy. And here's Deuteronomy again. That's chapter 14. Now chapter 26. So it's a key theme in the Deuteronomic. Today Yahweh has obtained your agreement to be his treasured people as he promised you. His special people. And it's nice to feel special. What they forgot and what Jesus was so clear about and what the Catholic Church, that's what it means, if it was serious about it all, must believe too, is that the surprise was that everyone is God's special possession. The people of India are God's special possession. The people of Ireland are God's special possession. The people of Mexico are God's special possession. They're all blooming special. Isn't that all right? If you had more than one kid, you'd know, you'd understand that without any explanation. They're all uniquely special to you. And if a little child thought that they were special to mum and others weren't, then you've got problems among the siblings, haven't you? You've got to help the little kid get used to the fact there's a baby on the way or you're going to have problems because the centre of attention might shift for a while. So they were all God's special possession. Here it is now, the prophet Malachi. They shall be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, my special possession, my segula, on the day when I act. And here we are, Psalm 135, verse 4. Yahweh has chosen Jacob for himself, Israel as his own treasured possession. And the word in Hebrew, in each of those, is segula. I think I've given you the lot. The last one, Book of Exodus, chapter 19, verse 5, that glorious text. If you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you'll be my treasured possession out of all the people. Now, how you look at that will depend. It looks like conditional love. You'll be special to me if you do this. And maybe that is the way they thought of it. I don't know how they thought of it. But the way I think we would think of it is not like that. It's just saying, like Jesus says, if you love me, if you keep my commandments, my Father will come to you and we will love you. I don't think that's conditional love. I think it's saying God's love is unconditionally offered and always offered to everyone. That's the constant. But it's only conditionally received. Do you see what I'm saying? Because if I'm closed, love won't force its way in. It can't and won't. So while it's unconditionally offered, there are conditions on it being received that you've got to welcome it. You've got to say yes to it. We've got to open ourselves to that love. And that's what's happening here. It's only by listening and obeying that we open our hearts. That's what I think they're saying at the deepest level, to receive this gift that God's given us. If we reject it, it doesn't happen. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 7. It is not because you were more numerous than the other people that Yahweh set his heart on you and chose you. We can apply this to ourselves, of course. You were the fewest of all peoples. It was because Yahweh loved you, Ahav. Yahweh committed himself to you and kept the oath that he swore to our ancestors, that Yahweh has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that Yahweh your God is God, the faithful God who maintains covenant loyalty, as my translation of chesed, maintains the loyalty to the covenant made. That's what hesed means, being faithful to the commitment that you've made. And those who love him, Ahav, and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations, comma, and who repays in their own person those who reject him. And literally the Hebrew is hate. It's the opposite to love. It's got nothing to do with feelings. It's just, to love is to be faithful to the commitment, to hate is to not be faithful to the commitment. So don't get it caught up in emotional words. So I've used the word reject here. He does not delay, but repays in their own person those who reject him. The point, it's a rather a subtle point, is that he doesn't blame the children for what their parents do or the parents for what their children do. This is actually quite an advance, because in the tribal world, everything's tribal. So if I do something wrong, you all do something wrong, and you all get punished for it. We're all... The idea of individuality and personal responsibility is actually quite a pretty advanced notion. And a lot of countries still are tribal, aren't they? So they act tribally, whereas this is an attempt to say, no, it's your own person that you are. And now Deuteronomy 7:26. Do not bring an abhorrent thing into your house, or you will be set apart for destruction. This is the cherem, same word. It's not just the others, you too will be destroyed, cherem, wiped out, if you bring something abhorrent, foreign god, into your house. And I've given you the Greek there of the Septuagint. I don't know if you know Greek letters, but I'll read it to you. Anathema. You know how it was used, anathema was used right through the church's history, anathema. And that's the word. It means set aside for destruction, really. It means not protected by the holy place. Excommunicated could be another kind of word for it. If someone believes this, they are anathema, meaning they are outside the protective love of the church. It's a bit primitive, but and therefore they are left to God without the protection of the community. You must utterly detest and abhor it, for it is set apart for destruction. Chapter 8. Remember the long way that Yahweh your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, in order that you would know affliction, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. He humbled you by letting you hunger and then feeding you with manna, with which neither you nor your ancestors were acquainted, in order to make you understand. And here's the third temptation, not the third temptation, the third text of the temptation. Understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. And that's quoted by Jesus in the first temptation, isn't it? In the desert. So the writers of the temptations, to jump to that, they're not saying Jesus had three temptations when he's in the desert. They're not saying that Jesus was 40 days in the desert fasting. 40 days in the desert, you okay with that? That's clearly what happened. It's seeing Jesus as the true Israel, the one who did what we didn't do. What you'll find, he actually obeyed God. He listened to God in the desert of life. It went on for 35 years for him, or 37. So the temptations is one aspect of all of our life, the testing, the trial. But he was faithful. And so when they write these, looking at the key temptations of all of our lives, summarising again the key aspects of life, they quoted from the book of Deuteronomy to let people go back to the Deuteronomy and see how faithful Jesus was as a Jew. Not unfaithful, but faithful. And they quote from this beautiful text here. And to conclude then, for the break, 8:19-20. If you do not forget Yahweh your God and follow other gods to serve and worship them, I solemnly warn you today, you will surely perish. Like the nations that Yahweh is destroying before you, so shall you perish, because you would not obey the voice of Yahweh your God. Oh. So put yourself in the exile again. And all of this really rings strong about going home again and what you need to do. We must start to really obey God, is what they're telling the people. The way our ancestors failed. But here's Moses telling them, well, we're telling you, Moses is telling you today, and we apply it, of course, to our own lives.